Thank you, Matthew. I am very aware that I'm the only thing standing between you and food, and that many of the things that I wanted to share today have already been raised by some of the speakers, so I'll try and keep it brief and not to repeat some of those ideas. And I'll just don't start taking the time yet. I'm just going to take the time here so I don't go over time. Not that I don't trust you. Okay. So I guess the way I chose to summarize the strand that I coordinate in this project is to set up the question of museums as media, but what kind of media? And what I've been trying to do in this strand is basically to look at the public understandings of climate change science and how that understanding takes place through the media and through different types of media, moving from the mass media, for-profit, commercial, mass broadcast media and press, and moving into other forms of media like community, alternative, and citizens' media, and how the different types of media engage differently, present in different ways, and communicate climate change in different ways, and whether there are gaps in these or lessons or creative opportunities for museums to acknowledge. I have been doing this through three different ways. There's not a very formal methodology, but one is to look at over 25 surveys conducted in Australia and worldwide about the communication of climate change in the media, and then looking at some scholarly literature, mostly coming from the sociology of climate change and communication theory and climate change, which are two very fertile fields these days. And then thirdly, to look at what some of you are doing here in Australia in very interesting ways, like Angelina Russo, Seb Chan, Linda Kelly, which is to look at social media in museums. I guess there's still a question that can be raised is up to what point we can ask the question of museums as social media, and we're still a bit far away from doing that. And I guess the ultimate aim is to try to mobilize the proposition that citizens' media, and I'll come back to this in a moment, and participatory communication models can be useful to conceptualize museums as media from a different point of view. And just to set the tone of what I'd like to share, two quotes, one from Mike Davis, a journalist and a climate change writer. "Our world, our old world that we have inhabited for the last 12,000 years has ended, even if no newspaper in North America or Europe has yet printed its scientific obituary." And the second one from William Gibson, who you probably know very well, who is of course not talking about climate change, when he says, "The future is already here, it is just not very evenly distributed." And this points out to two very important things, which is the importance of the political economy of climate change, as Mike Hume was talking this morning, but the less understood cultural and political geographies of climate change and how most of the views from the mainstream world media and news media have a very Eurocentric perspective. So I borrow my initial question that gather my thoughts from a Nigerian communication scholar, Alfred Opobor, that raises the question, if community media is the answer, what is the question? And through the last 3 years of this project, I've been raising lots and lots of questions, but not able that much to provide many answers, I'm afraid, so I'll share with you some of the questions. One of the dangers in my analysis is to try to avoid the danger of a media-centric point of view. And in analyzing how climate change is communicated in the media, how to avoid just relying on the analysis of media texts and the centrality of the media, and focus more on the mediations that and the social solidarities that are constructed around the use of media. I'm not going to touch too much on the framing of climate change because it's been done today, but some of the interesting results from preliminary results is the lack of effectivity in local news agencies generating news at local in a local setting. There's a lot of media pollution in the way that climate change is being disseminated. And one of the things that I've been trying to do, which is quite important in Latin American communication scholarship, but not so much in the English-speaking world, is to try to put forward the difference between information and communication. So we would talk about mass information media, to look at the Australian or the Sydney Morning Herald or the Guardian or Channel 9 or Channel 7, but not necessarily mass communication media. So I'll try to come back to that difference between the problem being not only misinformation, lack of information, saturation of information, overload of information, but also a lack of understanding between the difference between information, a one-way dissemination of data, and a more dialogic transfer of knowledge as in communication. And the root of the word communication has a common root with the word participation, not like information. It's important, as has been said, Fiona raised this issue, that the media still constitutes the main source of information, the shaping factor, in some cases a determining factor in the degree of awareness, concern, and critical awareness or conscientization by citizens or people around climate change. Also, problems with some of the surveys, and this is just a little taste of some of the ones I've been looking at, and I unfortunately don't have time to go into too much detail, but the UK Royal Science Society in 2001 producing some surveys that only 39% of over 1,000 respondents agreed with the statement the media presents science in a responsible way. This is being corroborated by some of the information that Fiona was presenting earlier on. A study made by the China Daily in 2008 showing that Chinese media rarely report on local climate change issues and activities, rarely mentions local research on climate change, and the view that climate change is primarily the responsibility of the developed world. Again, another indication of the importance of the cultural geography and the complexity of the North-South dynamics in responding to climate change. The Frederick Ebert Foundation funded a vast longitudinal study of 21 newspapers in Latin America, three from each of the seven largest countries, to find out that over a three-year period, 2005 to 2007, overall there was no more than 1% of news dedicated on climate change, and of these, 90% were mostly recycled scientific data coming from somewhere else, not locally generated information. Most of it was political events about global governance and other political events, and Mike Hume presented a work by, who was it, the four peaks of the events in the last 3 years, and all of them are in one sense or another political events. And lastly, climate events and disasters. So if the media is the most determining factor of critical awareness, what happens in countries where there's no information, let alone communication about climate change? There was a survey conducted with over 1,000 participants after the Cancun COP last year, with people responding from over 80 countries, journalists, lawyers, policymakers, scientists, activists. And three major conclusions. Lack of public understanding is a major obstacle inhibiting action on climate change. A climate movement at the ground level is needed to put pressure on politicians. Dealing with climate uncertainties requires political leadership. So I guess the goal here is to try and see up to what point there are gaps in the way that the mass media communicates climate change that can be creative opportunities for museums. And the idea of museums as media is not new. However, in my opinion, has not received too much detailed information with some particular exceptions which are listed there. So an early work by Roger Silverstone at the London School of Economics on some theoretical and methodological considerations of museums and the media. Then the work by Hooper Greenhill, providing a semiotic approach to understanding exhibits as systems of communication and linguistic systems. another work by Sharon MacDonald, looking at how museums can be considered media because of the way they articulate time and space. More recently, a materialist approach from Michelle Henning, looking at the theories of technological determinism by McLuhan in the 60s. And Miriam Levin makes the same question. If the premise of a museum as media can be accepted, then what sort of media are we? And how do we distinguish a museum from conventional media formats like the broadcast media? So I guess all of these books raise the question of museum of media, but not necessarily answer the question of how the museum can be thought of not as a broadcast media in the sense of a mass media format, but move beyond superficial understandings of exhibitions, displays, or experiences as a system of communication. And I think one entry point to just begin answering is to look at the concept of communicative ecologies, as first developed about 10 years ago by Don Slater from the London School of Economics and Joe Tykey from Queensland University of Technology. And I think this is an interesting entry point to evaluate the potential and real impacts of thinking museums as media. The museum as a producer of experiences, and not just display of objects, could be understood within a broader understanding of the whole structure of communication and information. Sorry, that's a very small font there, but I'll just explain in a minute. Each instance of communication or information takes place within an already existing communicative ecology, and each place, Sydney in this case, for example, or this part of Sydney, would have its own unique communicative ecology that we need to understand. So when we think about museums as media, we cannot do that without considering it as a species coming into an already existing ecology. So that species, the museum as media, can be there for 20 years, 30 years, or just be a newcomer into this new ecology. So what I have there at the beginning, at the center, is the museum, broadcast media, social media and P2P networks, social movements, but also transport systems. So the communicative ecology will consider not only the standard communication media, but other forms of communication, including transport, buses and trains. So how does the museum, if we accept the museum as media proposition, fit into pre-existing communication systems and social networks? Does it expand this already existing ecology? Does it construct? How does it relate to it? So any new connections and networks, social and technical, that a museum may be able to develop will be far more effective if they're somehow interconnected with existing locally appropriate systems and structures, as Brett was pointing out this morning. Also important about a communication ecology perspective is how new media articulates with older media. Does not replace, perhaps remediates older media, but what is that articulation between social media and older forms of media, particularly in the museum context? So if something can be learned from the literature coming out of communication and social change in the last 20, 30 years, both in English-speaking and other languages, particularly Latin America and also Africa, is that there's often a confusion between the notions of participation and access. Usually claims of participation are false, access just giving, you know, the opportunity for people to speak. But today, many people have a voice. So if everyone's speaking, you know, who is listening? And I point out to some work that colleagues at UTS, Penny O'Donnell, for example, here, have been doing around cultures of listening. So participation goes into a much deeper understanding of communities having decision-making roles and not only into programming. And I have been looking also at the questions of citizenship and contemporary political theories of citizenship, and how they speak about subjects that are defined as citizens by their daily political actions and engagements rather than their legal status. Citizenship conceived as a form of identification, and here I borrow some of the work from Chantal Mouffe, via the work or translated by the work from another communication scholar, a Colombian scholar called Clemencia Rodriguez, who has been looking at the notion of citizens' media. And she provides an interesting distinction between community media and alternative media and citizens' media. Community media, well, difficult to summarize in 30 seconds, but basically points to who produces the media and who is the target audience. The community produces, the community is the audience. Alternative media, basically looking at the binary opposition between an alternative to the mass commercial for-profit political economy or models of broadcasting. So it's always defined as an alternative to something else, but not for its intrinsic values. So she speaks about citizens' media in the way that people can become active political subjects or create their own political subjectivities through the way they use, appropriate, and engage collectively through the media. And her work is not only theoretical, but also talks about the experience of how citizens' media has been used in Colombia, a country that has had 50 years of civil war on and off, for people to construct their notions of citizenship by the use of media outside of the government, public, commercial forms of communication. So how can museums be thought of as citizens' media? That is, as mediators that facilitate the transformation of individuals into citizens, how these citizens' audiences activate communication processes of social change within museum spaces in relation to museums and science centers, which shape, in turn, their local communities with regards to pressing questions, in this case, climate change. In other words, how museums make possible the occurrence of what Engin Isin calls acts of citizenship, those moments when, regardless of status and substance, subjects constitute themselves as citizens. I don't have time to more than mention an interesting report that came out of a study produced by scholars in Griffith University about community media in Australia, particularly radio. And one of the interesting findings is that more people than ever before in Australia are listening to community radio. It's more important than ever before since 1973, when the first programs were developed. So this idea of museums as citizens' media takes me to another related concept, which is the importance of climate change storytelling, not just providing information, not just disseminating information, but the importance of storytelling. And Mike Hume was talking about, you know, the voice, who are the voices in climate change. Also important, again, is who are the listeners of this story. And climate change storytelling becomes relevant when inquiring what people know about climate change, how is this knowledge acquired, and whose knowledge is it anyway. And here I had been working with a notion from an Indian anthropologist of science, Viv Visvanathan, who has been working with the concept of cognitive justice. And for him, we need to move beyond, or there's a need to think of cognitive diversity amongst the agents of definition. In this regard, he thinks there's a lack of cognitive justice in climate change debate. And by cognitive justice, he introduces a major ethical dimension to the communication of climate change, and science more generally, of course, by questioning the lack of dialogue, acknowledgements between different knowledges and perspectives held by scientific knowledge and other epistemologies. This also relates to some of the interesting concepts developed by Sheila Jasanoff and his notion of civic epistemologies. And she says that the public understanding of science framework obliterates lay and other forms of knowledge. It diminishes civic agency, erases history, neglects culture, and privileges people's knowledge of isolated facts over the mastery of more complex frames of meaning. She also says climate change produces discordances in established ways of understanding the human place in nature. So we can begin to understand this if we look at, for example, the role or the treatment of traditional indigenous people in climate change policy documents, or the lack thereof. Miriam Mackie has done an interesting study about the invisibility of indigenous people and local responses to climate change in major policy documents like the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, the Kyoto Protocol, the Stern Review, and the fourth and last IPCC report. So when they're mentioned, indigenous people strategies, most of it is indigenous people living in developed countries, Australia, Canada, the United States, and the polar regions, in the Arctic. So rarely indigenous people living in everywhere in the world receive any mention, let alone local strategies. So part of the work has also been looking, trying to complement the work that theorists and practitioners here in Sydney and in Melbourne have been doing about social media. And unfortunately, I'm running out of time to summarize the whole part of the project. But it's interesting how the question of how social media, in fact, extend and perpetuate dominant ideologies, commodify cultures, such as consumer and popular culture, need to be brought into attention when looking at social media in museums. How can museums using social media challenge those forms? How can we think of museums as providers of platforms, moving from groups to audiences to networks and back to local groups? I was going to mention a game, but I don't have the time, that I've been looking at, but I have written about that. It's a game developed by Jane McGonigal in California, the Superstructure game. And if social media is a mean to an end rather than the end itself, what is the end itself of social media museums, and what, you know, Linda Kelly and Seb Chan and others have been doing, is to use social media to enact engagement. And I think this is a really important creative opportunity for museums. Now, this does not mean the challenges. Also trying to understand communication not as information, dissemination, enhancing visibility or marketing, but more a process of strengthening social organizations and networking in support of participation. So museums are not just safe places to say unsafe things, or places to come together, but also places to foster that those acts of citizenship. Do I have any more time to conclude? No, I don't have time. So I'll just leave it there. I've spoken for 22 minutes. But these are the conclusions. Thank you very much.